you.
Okay, the Economic Development Housing Budget Division will come to order for February 11th, 2009. And we're going to be doing some more budget overviews today. Is the Department of Labor and Industry here?
Because there are more of us, I suppose.
Would you like to go an hour? Or you want, would you like? We can wait for a couple hours if you want to wait for it.
So where are we?
Mr. Wiggum, welcome to the committee.
See you.
Where are we in this book?
You're gonna be going through your budget, and because when Senator Cohen comes in, he'll want to know that you're going through the budget document. Okay. All right. So,
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here with DLI to give you our budget. Budget numbers are certainly the changes that have been recommended by the governor. Mr. Chairman, and to stand ready for any questions, I do have with me our CFO of DLI, Cease Jackson, and the two assistant commissioners are also with us in the back if we need any specific information regarding any specific units. Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay, I would spend 5 minutes giving you the quick overview, the quick feel of the department, an idea of dollars, where they come from, full-time equivalents, go into the change orders very briefly, and then turn to Ms. Jackson for the specifics of the governor's recommendations that are before you, Ms. Chairman, if that'd be okay?
That sounds good.
And we'll try to do it within 10 minutes of presentation, and then certainly Senator, take any questions for as long as you would want.
Senator Cohen isn't here yet, so you can have the first 5 minutes. For
so
the,
we can keep yeah, going. Yeah, it's to get done before Senator Cohen comes? Speed up. Okay. Very quickly. Well,
very quick,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Quorum is present. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we have basically 5 units within the Department of Labor and Industry. To many of you, we have been in your offices and certainly given you an overview as well as the mission of the department and the mission of the various units. Let me specifically refer to some numbers that you can have in your background. First of all, the department has about 488 positions that are allowed to us. We have 451 of those positions filled today. So there are some openings, and I think out of some prudence and some wisdom, we have kept some of those positions open, depending upon what happens with the budgets here at the Capitol by the end of this legislative session. Our workers' compensation division unit, Mr. Chairman, runs on $159 million of assessment we make on premiums to businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. $159 million. We have 90 employees within workers' compensation. Actually, it's 90.6. Out of that $159 million, Mr. Chairman, about $142 million of the dollars go out in benefits to injured workers in the state of Minnesota. The other $17 million approximately is used to run the department, our staff, the dispute resolution, the Office of Administrative Hearings. Mr. Chairman, we make an assessment each and every year on workers' compensation premiums. The $142 million, Mr. Chairman, members, is basically spent in three different areas. First of all, previous to 1995 reform bill, we had what was called supplementary benefits. About $100 million goes out in supplementary benefits to injured workers in the state previous to 1995. We had second injury fund. Second injury fund benefits in the state are about $24 million. And then we have about $18 million that does cover uninsured persons in the state who work for employers who happen to be uninsured, even though workers' comp is mandatory. As you and I know, there are some that are uninsured, and there are some businesses that go bankrupt. So we have $18 million that goes in that direction for those injured employees. Mr. Chairman, our OSHA department. Our OSHA department runs on federal funds and workers' comp assessment premiums. It's $24 million to run our OSHA department. That's both departments of consultation and compliance together. We have 99 employees within those two departments of OSHA consultation and OSHA compliance. Construction codes and licensing. CCLD, we call it. It's the combined licensing of that was combined from the in the state about 3 years ago, first with an executive order, I believe, by Governor Plenty, and then passed by the legislature. We issue there somewhere in the neighborhood of 110,000 licenses per year. Electricians, plumbers, your constituents that are high-pressure pipers, contractors get all their licenses from the CCLD department. CCLD is run all then on fees. Fees that your individual electricians, plumbers pay to the state to do the testing and the licensing. $62 million, about 163 employees within CCLD. Fourthly, we have the labor standards unit. Labor standards is divided into two areas. One is the labor standard enforcement and compliance itself. That's child labor, minimum wage, complaints that we investigate and enforce, prevailing wage. $2.3 million and, $1.7 million, $1.7 million and 12 and a half employees within that unit of labor standards. The other part of labor standards is our apprenticeship program in the state that that we run, we approve, we oversee. And the apprenticeship program is 6.5 employees, members, with a total a dollar amount of $2.3 million, which comes from workforce development funds. And then lastly, I would put in the fifth unit our general support unit, Mr. Chairman. General support would be everything that runs the other units that the other units need, from a legal advice. We have a legal department to communications, the communications department, to the IT, technology department. The general support division is $23 million and 118 employees. Mr. Chairman, that is basically the overview of the department, the number of FTEs and the dollar amounts. As you can see, we get significant monies from the feds to run OSHA. We have significant monies from fees, that's license fees, permit fees. We have significant monies from the workers' compensation assessment that we do on businesses in the state. Mr. Chairman, we have very little general fund money. The general fund money that we do have all goes to the labor standards unit. And that unit is the one that I explained that enforces minimum wage, prevailing wage, child labor laws in the state. But that's the only place where our general fund money goes. Very briefly, I'm going to review the governor's recommendation, and then Ms. Jackson will follow through with your questions and further on that. I would say four basic large recommendations from the department in the governor's budget recommendations. The first is that we have recommended going to biennial licenses, every 2 years rather than every year. Senators, I think it's a good thing to do whether we were in a budget crunch or not. I think it's a reasonable thing to do to say we'll give a license for an electrician for a two-year period of time, renew it at every 2 years, or for a plumber or whatever the profession may be. Obviously, in doing so, we will get some monies up front in the first year of the biennium that we would have been in the first and second year of the biennium. And Ms. Jackson will explain that a little bit further as we go along. Secondly, we are the governor is recommending an increase in building permit and plan review fees. Basically, members, a lot of local municipalities have adopted the increase over the past year, steadily increased their fee structure. The state has not done so, and we are recommending that we increase our fee structure in the similar way that the local municipalities have. Mr. Chairman, the third major change that I would suggest, or that the governor is recommending, and a very, very positive one for our department, would be the elimination of a $1.5 million annual transfer from construction codes to the general fund. It was placed in law how many years ago?
Three years ago.
My understanding at that time, and we all remember different things, is it was supposed to be a one-time transfer of $1.5 million. Somehow it got put in law as a permanent annual 1.5 transfer. Those things do happen. That's my memory of being here sitting in your chairs with you. And the governor has rightfully, I believe, recommended the elimination of that transfer for us of that $1.5 million. Basically, the governor is protecting the integrity of the various funds by so doing. Our general fund money, of course, again, runs labor standards unit. But the governor is recommending that fees, permits, fees, license fees, workers' compensation premiums, those funds be kept, that we respect the integrity of those funds, and we not use those funds for any other purposes within the state. And I was going to mention one other change real quickly. Then in our general fund, Mr. Chairman, the governor is recommending a $100,000 reduction in each year of the biennium to our labor standards unit. Maybe if it'd be okay, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Thomasoni, I'd turn to Ms. Jackson to, again, review maybe more in depth the governor's recommendations. And stand for any questions that you might have.
Just explain the $1.5 million. That's been coming out of the construction code fund to the general fund. And the governor is suggesting eliminating that transfer now, which will then stay in the construction code fund. Is that what I'm
that is
understanding?
Correct.
So it'll be a $1.5 million hit to the general fund?
It would be a $1.5 million hit per year to the general fund. That is correct.
Okay. And are you suggesting a use for this money within the department then, or a reduction in fees, or what?
The answer, Mr. Chairman, to that would be yes to both. We have just taken upon the department a fee study as to whether the size of our fees are appropriate or not and what they are used for. But secondly, Mr. Chairman, we have cash flowed out the CCLV dollars through the year 2011 with or without this $1.5 million either being in the general fund or within the CCLV department. And Mr. Chairman, as we keep our cash flow, which we need about a three-month cash flow there within the department, within CCLD, we need a three-month cash flow so we can write out checks, just like you do in your own personal life. If we do not transfer that $1.5 million, we become dangerously low in the year 2011.
That's correct.
In the year 2011, in regards to the cash flow that we do have there within the CCLD unit.
I'll ask later.
Okay, Ms. Jackson, go ahead.
They have this cash flow.
You're going to do the numbers, right, from the book?
If you'd like to do that, sure.
Well, what were you planning? If that isn't what I would like to do.
Well, I wasn't quite sure what level of detail you wanted to go in, so I was thinking that I would go. Oh, sorry. I'm sure you're all. I'm sorry. I'm Cecilia Jackson, the CFO at the Department of Labor and Industry. And my plan was to have the commissioner do the quick overview, which he did, and then to spend some time going through each of the change pages. We do have five, three in the CCLD division, construction code division, and two in our labor standards area.
Okay, and those are the governor's recommendations for this particular budget session?
Yes.
And nothing else would change?
That's correct.
Okay, that's a good idea then. Go ahead and go through them, the change items.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Thomasoni.
And then let me know which page you're on
I am on page 9.
Okay.
And that's the biennial license renewal and scheduling.
Before you go to page 9, I see a change on page 6. Are you getting back to that? You're on. Wait, what are you on? Page 9 of what?
The biennial budget. Oh, no, not that one.
The big book?
The big book.
Budget page.
Mr. Chairman, what you have before you is just a handout that we had from the department.
Yeah, I don't want you to go through that.
Just for the members' background information.
Page 9. Well, on page 6, there's...
Are you getting back to the budget? The actual budget book.
Well, that's a summary. Okay, that's the agency overview. Okay, all right, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Page 9 is the Construction Codes Division, biennial license renewal and scheduling process, the change page that we have submitted. If you look at the dollars, we're pulling forward $2.7 million. And again, this is not new money. These are dollars that would occur naturally from 1 year to the next. We're just pulling them forward to the first year of the biennium so that we can do the biennial license process. And we would do this, the biennial license process, renewal process, on approximately 66,000 licenses.
Labor and industry.
There are roughly 38,000 boiler operators, 13,000 plumbers, and 14 or almost 15,000 water and residential contractors. And the plan is to move to a biennial structure, and we would do that by staggering the licenses out in any given year and also pulling forward one group in the first year, 2010, half of them, and they would renew for 2 years, and then one group would renew for 1 year, so that in 2011, then they would renew for 2 years.
Has your computer program got this all figured out, or are we going to have to
give
you all kinds of money
for that? I have an analyst that has this
figured out.
Okay. But one of the things that we also wanted to do was to work with the various industries to make sure that it falls in line with their, we're not conflicting with their training schedule, their construction schedules, and all of those types of things. So we're not asking you to define in law that boiler operators, for example, are going to be March 31st. What we're asking you to do is to just give us the flexibility so that we can have the biennial licenses. That way we can work that out with the various industries, and if we make a mistake, we can correct that.
Do you need legislative approval to change how you collect the fees? Can you do that?
We do need the approval to have the biennial license cycle.
Okay. So they'd be paying for 2 years up front?
One time, correct. And then by being able to do this, in the second year, we're looking at actual cost reductions of about $250,000, $285,000 because we would save money just in postage, mailing the annual renewals, those types of things. In my office and financial services, we have to hire, I have to hire an additional person to do the deposits of all of these licenses. It's an enormous task because this is on top of the other additional licenses that come in. In some months, we may have anywhere from 20 to 30,000 licenses that we need to make deposits for. Other months, it's as low as 3,000, 2,000 renewals that are occurring at that time. So we want to level out the peaks and valleys that are occurring. That'll help throughout our agency, just in the mailroom, our office, and the folks that are actually trying to work with the electricians and all of these folks to make those annual renewals. And one of the other things that we're adding is the elimination of the fee charges for replacement licenses. Some licenses, there's a charge for replacement cost. Other licenses, there is not. We want to take advantage of our technology, and if you're licensed, and you'll be able to go online and using certain password configurations, print that document at your convenience so that there will not be a charge for that in the future. So we're also eliminating that. We're trying to find various ways that we can eliminate some of these impediments for folks to do their job and to get that business and do their work. Let's see. And on page 10, there's a quick summary there that shows the dollars that would be brought forward. In biennial license cycle itself, $1.4 million, and also the contractor recovery. We would have to make that a two-year cycle for that as well. By making this change, we believe that we will increase the stability for the workforce in our office as well as improve customer service for those that we serve, our various contractors. And at this point, we did not want to increase the license fees. Within the CCLD division, we've been working for a number of months on evaluating our fee structures, you know, taking a look at those. I had asked that we have a one-page document. Well, it's three pages. There's lots of different fees. Some are 20, some are 15, some are 120. And as we came together from the five various sections, we're now at the point where we need to do the analysis to figure out what is the appropriate rate for the combined CCLD division for these various licenses. And that will be our next step. We just ran out of time and not able to prepare that particular document for this year. But it is part of our work plan. There are currently over 17 various categories of licensure, just licensure types. And we'd like to get that down to about three or four with a fee rate that makes sense. It's intuitive and it makes sense to those that we serve as well as to ourselves. And so that proposal hopefully you'll be seeing next year or whenever that's possible.
And are you working with the stakeholders here to make sure that everybody can figure this out and handle what's going on and not be all confused and wondering whether or not they've been renewed or...
Yes, we are working with the stakeholders. Our assistant commissioner has been in touch with them. In fact, just a few minutes before this session started, he was in contact with the various business organizations.
And is it going the right direction?
Actually, we have not heard any pushback or comments that this is not a good idea.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I could,
sure.
And to the members, as this gets on to the next change order, let me say from my perspective, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think this is the right thing to do, whether we have a budget difficulty or not. It'll help us better serve your constituents. Many of you probably got calls, and in all fairness, all honesty, our department did have some difficulty last spring when all contractor licenses came due at one time. We couldn't get them out the door. And I'll bet you some of you had calls. Senator Koch shakes her head that you did. We did have some difficulty. This will help us operate within the department with more efficiency, taking these licenses and getting them out for your contractors or your professionals on time. It'll help the efficiency of the department as well as serve your constituents better.
So this isn't going to be like the UI computer, is it?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have unemployment in our...
I know. I'm worried about your computer. That's what I'm worried about. Okay.
All right.
Go ahead.
Okay. The next change page is on page 11. Building permit and plan review fee adjustment. And what we are looking at here is an actual fee increase in our building and permit and plan review fees. We have not increased our fee for the last 18 years, since 1990. What we're finding is that other municipalities, such as we evaluated the city of Bloomington, St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester, and St. Paul, and some of their fees, or actually all of the fees that we looked at across those six or seven cities, were much higher than our rate, which was established back in 1990. If you look at the fee schedule at the bottom of page 11, the reinspection fee, we currently charge $45 an hour. The city of Minneapolis, and these fees took place in April of 2008. Their hourly rate is $63.25. What we're looking for here is market equity across the building plan review process across the state. One of the things that we are finding is that municipalities are accepting the plan reviews, and then they're turning around and sending them to us because they charge the 60-some dollars. They can send that work to us for $45 and recoup the difference. So we're just looking for some equity in how these things are handled. We don't believe that the rates that we would like to adopt in the city of Minneapolis are exorbitant. They're in keeping with what the other municipalities are charging. And within this building permit and plan review process, we are running a deficit within this area. Currently, in 2008, approximately a little more than $700,000. In 2009, we project about the same, about $730,000 deficit in this area. And through the end of next year, about $750,000. So over the course of just 3 years, we're losing funds of a little over $2 million. And if you turn the page, page 12, you'll see that at bottom of the chart, for plans that are valued at over $100,000, over $500,000, and over $1 million, there's a good 50% difference between what we charge and what the city of Minneapolis charges. We are seeing that the number of building permits is increasing. In 2007, it was 146 permits. that were issued, and in 2008, 171. And in terms of the number of building plans reviewed, that's also increased from 2007, from 275,000 to 304. We do view this proposal as a market equity proposal to make sure that, one, we are recouping our deficit, and also to make sure that we are in line with the other municipalities. And again, we have not increased this fee in 18 years.
So $45 an hour isn't enough?
We are currently running a deficit.
And but what's the reason?
Pardon?
Are you running a deficit based on what Minneapolis does, or are you running a deficit based
based on the amount that we have to pay for, the engineering staff to do these plan reviews.
Mr. Chairman, we have done an internal analysis within Ms. Jackson's department, and they have determined with the hours that are involved that we do not recover the costs for the fee, the service that's given for the fee.
So you contract this out?
No, we do it.
No, we have internal engineering staff that perform these plan reviews.
And they're not part of your budget?
Yes, they are part
of
our budget.
So how do they cost you money then?
We have to pay Mr. Chair, Senator Tomsoni, we have to pay the salaries for the current rate for the engineering staff.
Right.
The $45 an hour does not cover the work that's required, as well as the administrative costs associated with doing these plan reviews. It's extensive amount of time that's required. And
aren't they on staff?
They're on staff.
They are on staff.
So how do they not get paid? How do their costs not get covered then if they're on staff?
Mr. Chair, the $45 an hour does not cover the overall administrative rate. When you look at the engineer salary, the fringe that we have to pay, the indirect costs, health care costs, indirect costs, it does not cover that. And so what happens is, we are paying the engineer salaries, but for every dollar that we're bringing in, we're losing a few cents. And that few cents is adding up to, on an annual rate or an annual pay period, about $17,000.
Okay. Any questions on this? Okay. What's next?
The next proposal and change page is again in the construction codes area. This is the elimination of the construction code transfer of the $1.5 million. As our commissioner has stated, it was not the intention that this continue long term. And we are now at the point where our operating dollars are going to be are not sufficient to cover our annual operating costs within this division. Roughly, we need about $7.5 million per year in operating dollars. These are not surplus dollars. These are operating dollars to fund salaries, operations, rent, indirect costs, and the other activities associated with running this program. I have projected that should this $1.5 million continue by the end of 2011, we would only have about $3.5 million in this operating fund at any point in time. That may seem like it's sufficient. However, to put it in perspective, for each payroll period that occurs, we need approximately $1.5 million per pay period, so that's roughly every 2 weeks, and in order to pay all of our expenses and obligations. We have looked at an alternative to the offset of the $1.5 million. We currently license approximately 105,000 licenses. If we were to add a $15 per year additional surcharge to those licenses, then we could continue making this particular payment.
So an alternative to not drawing down the general fund would be to increase licenses by $15? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. How much did they go up when we did the code consolidation?
The annual licenses?
Yeah, didn't the licenses go up on the code
consolidation? No, the licenses have not gone up.
What did we increase when we did code consolidation? I thought we increased a whole bunch of license fees.
Oh, licenses?
Electrical?
Electrical only.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. We did increase the electrical fees.
That's it? And that was it? Okay.
That's correct.
The CDs are charging more.
Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. What's next?
Well, let me just give you a little bit more information. For example, there's a large category of electrical licenses. Boiler licenses, for example, the last time we changed those was in 2005. Some of the electrical licenses have not been changed since 1991. Let's see, high pressure piping has not changed since 2005. Plumbing has not changed since 1993. That's why I indicated that we would be looking at our license fees as kind of a next step and bringing back a proposal to, there will be some winners and losers in terms of kind of leveling off these fees and licensure fees and looking at a smaller number of categories so that intuitively it makes sense and we can look at our programs and know, okay, this license includes part of the inspection fee, maybe an exam, as well as licensing activities, so that we know what exactly we're paying for, or your clients or the contractors know what they're paying for when they're paying for that license. Page 14, the apprenticeship program expansion. This is the first of two proposals within the labor standards section, and that includes labor standards and apprenticeship. This proposal is to expand the apprenticeship program to include non-construction trades programs, which include healthcare, transportation, energy, some of the technology ones. The training programs are a minimum of 1 year when you have these apprenticeship programs. And there are currently 314 registered programs across Minnesota. When we look at the biotechnology industry, for example, we're looking at laboratory technicians and also in the healthcare field, some of the pharmacy technicians. And these are good paying jobs. And what we would like to do is to expand these to the non-construction areas, which would also promote opportunities for dislocated workers, welfare to work participants, mid-career professionals seeking a change, and workers with disabilities. We would work with DHS. They identify individuals that are ready and able to participate in these programs, as well as working with high school students in alternative and transition programs. We have already partnered with the Department of Human Services, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, education centers, the Minnesota State College and University System. And we are looking for, or there's two primary goals, to provide education and hands-on assistance, as well as sponsorship of 8-week pre-apprenticeship classes for those individuals that are seeking positions. In the first year, we would be looking for $250,000, and that would be to cover the expenses associated with two professional positions and one clerical position. And also, we would start the work of creating the 8-week pre-apprenticeship training, and as well as screening participants, the apprenticeship participants, and setting up mechanisms for financial assistance so that they would get some assistance to participate in these types of programs. In the second year, we'd be looking at $500,000. Again, the $250,000 would continue. We would continue with the two professionals and one clerical, and then we would expand the program so that in the second year and thereafter, we would be able to provide some financial assistance for employers to help them offset some of the costs associated with bringing in apprentices.
Are you talking apprenticeship fees here? Is that what you're talking to fund this? Or
workforce development fund.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, I guess. You know, at the bottom of page 14, it mentions, the increase in your base budget. Do you know if is that increase in your base there, is that included in the governor's recs? Do you know?
Yes, Senator, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kulash.
Mr. Chair, my question is, who is asking for the apprenticeships, number one, what industries, and is this supplanting some other licensors or other certifications coming out of MNSCU, for example, or community colleges or other training programs?
Ms. Jackson.
Senator, in response, this is in addition to the traditional construction industry, so this is in addition to
I understand that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I do understand that. What I'm kind of wondering is these apprenticeship classes, it sounds like you're looking to help in the healthcare industry and some other industries, but isn't there already a training and STEP program within qualifications that are saying what's in a medical assistant, for example, and so on up the line for that? And I'm just trying to figure out, is this a duplicate of some of the things that we already have, or is this something really new?
Well, Senator, in response, currently within the healthcare system, there is the TMA programs, trained medical assistant, as well as nursing assistant programs. The nursing assistant program is, I can't recall, some 90, 100 and some hours. These programs require a minimum of 1 year of training. And so it's much more extensive than the current programs that currently exist. In the healthcare area, we're looking at pharmacy technicians, for example.
I think what you're trying to ask, is there a hue and cry for this?
Well, it's some of that, but some of it is it seems to me that there's already training going on and standards already going on for pharmacy assistants, for example, and for nursing assistants, et cetera, that's already in place. So I can't quite understand the need for an apprenticeship qualification or spending money on apprenticeships for those if they're already there, unless you're talking about needing money for training or something differently than that, or if there's a cry from businesses to try to get some apprenticeship funding. I'm just trying to get an idea of the reason for this outside. I mean, I understand construction completely, and I understand there's other training programs. I'm not sure that I understand that this apprenticeship idea is really adding something to the current labor training that's already going on and standards within each industry.
Ms. Jackson.
Mr. Chairman.
You want to respond to that question?
Yes, actually, I'm wondering if the top line of the top two lines on page 15 explains some of that. Is that applicable to what you've told us about this apprenticeship?
Right. We
this is what we kind of be reimbursing the employer a little bit for some of the training and production.
Right. We would provide an offset and in some financial assistance for employers for the apprenticeship participation. I believe your question is a little bit broader than that. Does the industry really want this? I think is your question.
Beyond that, it's also, isn't there already a standardization in place, a step process for people to go through within both the medical industry and several others that say this is your qualifications and it's based on the training they have or expands on experience? And so I'm not quite sure what having an apprenticeship program does to that mix or to what it adds to it, other than if it's helping reimburse employers. That's not really what an apprenticeship program is for. It's for training qualified people. So,
Senator, for example, in the healthcare industry, there are gaps in terms of the trained medical assistant, then you move to the nursing assistant, mm-hmm. and then you have your LPN and your registered nurse. Between the nursing assistant and your LPN is typically 9 months and perhaps even 2 years now worth of training. There are positions that are available that would meet the minimum qualifications of at least 1 year of training and support. I believe that the industries are wanting this, and we do have their support to create these apprenticeship programs.
Mr. Chair, well, I just have a follow-up, if I could. May help to answer the question. Senator Kielos, you're not in the Business and Jobs Committee. Wish Senator Metson was here, because we had a wonderful discussion on exactly this with some industry folks on Monday of this week. And, in fact, it came as a discussion, as part of a bigger discussion that we were having. And Senator Metson expressed a desire to have a whole committee hearing devoted just to this, because industry is saying they would like better training. And there's sort of this different attempts from some from higher ed, some from local communities, some from the industry, some from high schools, all trying to get at better trained employees. And we had a discussion of college prep versus career readiness. There's a lot of college prep, but not everybody goes to college was part of the discussion. And are there other education opportunities? And I think this might help provide for that. But what I am finding from when I talk to different industries and employers is there is a need for further training. They'd like to see different opportunities for training. Just my experience.
Commissioner, this is pretty interesting, because, I mean, you went from your legislative career to this career where you're now involved with all these union people and overseeing them, and now you're looking at dislocated workers and MFIP participants and workers with disability. I mean, you've come the whole cycle here. I mean, it's pretty.
He was part of the union before he came here, remember.
I'm really impressed.
I am.
This is really something. Yeah. Okay. I don't know what we're going to do with this thing, but anyway,
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, you better be careful. You'll be signing up for a union before you leave.
Chairman, I was a union.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Mr. Chairman, in Representative Kubley's district, or
he's a senator now.
Senator,
your house broken, and now you got it.
He's used to being in the house. Yeah, you got to remember.
Senator Kubley, I apologize.
There you go. That's okay.
That's all right.
Okay, Ms. Jackson, what's next?
Our final
are you done with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Our next proposal and final proposal is on page 16. And this is our operating budget reduction, again, in the labor standards and apprenticeship program. Within labor standards and apprenticeship, this is the only area within labor and industry that has general fund dollars. We currently have $1.9 million, and this is a reduction from $1.9 to $1.7 million. We would be reducing this is a base budget reduction recommended by the governor, and we will be, again, maintaining our highest level of services that is possible within the $1.7 million. This is a reduction of one professional FTE. And we do anticipate that there will be some delays in our outreach and response to educational requests and those types of things. But we believe that we can continue to deliver a high level of service. Just to give you a highlight, some numbers here, from 2007 to 2008, the number of investigations that were opened increased by 35%, from 463. Cases closed moved from 331 in 2007 to 2008, 466. So an increase of 40%. But we are going to try to continue and deliver good service and respond to those requests for information, as well as investigations of wage and hour and employment law issues.
Ms. Jackson, is this one FTE currently working, or is it an empty spot?
This is one FTE that is currently employed at labor and industry.
And you will be laying this person off, or will you be redeploying them somewhere else?
At this point, within our planning purposes, we would be laying this person on.
And, Commissioner, you talked about, I think, if I wrote this down right, you had 488 positions, of which currently 451 are are filled, so you have 37 empty positions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, we do have some open positions at this time that the various units have prudently and wisely kept open, recognizing the difficulty of the budgets that we were forthcoming in this last year.
And are the 37 positions reflected in the budget document as being reductions or as being the amount you need to fill them? Is there, how can we tell if we're looking at what we're dealing with here exactly? Are we dealing with the 451 or are we dealing with the 488?
Within the budget, Senator Thomasoni, within the budget document, these positions are contained within the compensation line items that you'll see.
The 37 are in the they're funded in the budget document.
They're funded within the budget document at this point.
But they're not going to be filled.
Correct, because some of the positions that we have within our various sections, particularly in the construction codes area, there are 26 vacant positions there. We are looking at six elevator positions, six escalator, I believe. It's a variety of positions across the construction codes area. And given the market forces that are occurring, for example, our electrical inspections are down about 11%, which is $800,000. Our building surplus fund in 2009 is down, a high percentage. And let me see. That is down almost 16%, the building permit surcharge fees that we bring in, or about $400,000 so far this year.
And so we're
monitoring what is happening in the industry, and we may fill those positions or may not fill those positions.
And so is this one FTE that we're talking about part of those 37? Or they're part of, it's part of the 451, right?
It's so part of the 451, yes.
Okay. Why would you eliminate this one as opposed to just not filling one of the other ones?
Mr. Chairman, different funds. Labor Standards operates with general fund money, and some of the other units, CCLD, workers' compensation, operate with funds either from fees and or federal monies and or workers' compensation premiums.
Okay. Speaking of which, as long as you brought that up, workers' compensation, your reserves, the budgetary reserves, are going down every single year, it looks like, based on this, the workers' compensation special fund. I don't know if you have this chart, but it looks like this year it'll be at about $28.6 million, and by 2013 it'll be at about $14 million. Are you planning on making sure that this gets fixed so that it doesn't run out, and whether if you have to increase fees, you'll do so, or whatever the issue takes to make sure the fund stays stable?
Mr. Chairman, we do need to have the fund stable with about 3 to 4 months of dollars available there to pay special compensation, to pay say, supplementary benefits, to pay second injury fund benefits. We adjust our assessment accordingly. We do assess it. Our yearly, we do make that assessment. Now, last year, we did not increase the assessment at all. There will be, Mr. Chairman, of course, through natural years as they progress, the dollar amount needed within those funds is going to reduce. Obviously, persons right now who are receiving supplementary benefits, unfortunately, next year, two or three or some of those individuals will probably pass on or will pass away. And the same is true with second injury fund benefits. So over a period of time, those benefits that we pay will be reduced in magnitude and size of what is needed for our fund to be able to pay from.
Unless they're replaced by new people.
unless
they're replaced by new claims, which
Mr. Chairman, there can be no new claims in second injury fund or in supplementary benefits. Both of those benefits were curtailed, were eliminated in the 1995 bill.
Okay. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who would answer this, but if this was this budget developed using zero-based budgeting, and if so, how could we tell the difference?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, no, it was not. Although we would, from the concept in the intent of zero-based budgeting to make sure that every program is justified, every dollar is justified, I think that we can say that we did do that as we put it together. Maybe I also need to clarify one other thing, Mr. Chairman, for you. In anticipation of the use of the special compensation fund, while I say the second injury fund benefits and the supplementary benefits will naturally be going down this year and next year and the year after that, I think we were probably all wise enough to assume that maybe those benefits paid to workers who are not covered at work or from businesses that have gone bankrupt may, with the economic times as they are, may increase a little bit this year and next year. So, Mr. Chairman, there may be some offset there. It would be hard for us to judge exactly what the offset is, but I think both you and I would recognize with the economy as it is that there will probably be more claims on the uninsured worker coverage.
Any questions or comments? Anything else? Okay. All right. I don't think I have anything yet. I'm sure there'll be some bills coming through that might end up requiring you to come back in front of us eventually to talk about some stuff. So, and unless anybody else has a question here, I think you are excused for today.
Thank you. And maybe just one last thing to finish up, Mr. Chairman, with Senator Kalash. Our unit supervisor in labor standards who handles the apprenticeship program, Rosalind Wade, Ms. Wade, maybe I would also have her call you to address your question just a little bit more directly so you get a more satisfactory answer from us.
Thank you.
That's a good idea. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senators.
Board of Tourism.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Edmond. I'm the director of Explore Minnesota Tourism.
Welcome to the committee again, Mr. Edmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you for this opportunity to talk a little bit about Explore Minnesota Tourism. Also with me today are Colleen Tollefson, my industry relation manager, as well as Peggy Nasby, my operations manager, who can help me out with some of the more difficult questions you may ask. Basically, what I'm going to do... and in the time that allowed, I'll try to be relatively brief, talk a little bit about the industry, the Minnesota tourism industry, the agency profile, what our goals and measurements are, spend a little more extra time on our budget, industry outlook, and talk a little bit about the future, and be sure I allow enough time for any questions that you may have.
Mr. Edmond, what we're kind of, I don't mind giving a little overview of what you do, but I'm what we're really concerned about is the budget, how it affects you, and what the cuts are and what kind of jobs you might be losing. So give a quick overview, but kind of, if you can, focus in on the budget, okay?
All right, Mr. Okay. Chairman, members, I'll try to focus on that. The overview is just about the size of the Minnesota tourism industry. You have a lot of that information. Why we do it, it's the return on the investment. Thing that I think, Mr. Chairman, you and your members are interested in is that we're about revenue and jobs for the state. Two interesting facts worth mentioning is that 15% of all the state sales tax generated in Minnesota come from the leisure and hospitality industry. Our industry represents over 10% of the private sector jobs in the state, and those are just directly related to the travel and tourism industry.
Is the Mall of America included in tourism?
In the leisure and hospitality. Actually, this does not include retail.
Okay. All right. So those 40 million people that they tell us that are coming from all over the place, though, you don't count them?
Not in the jobs picture. No, I don't.
Okay. All right.
They want to come and move here, Mr. Chairman? We're glad to have them.
Okay.
Our mission is basically very simply to promote travel to and within the state of Minnesota. We represent both private and public sector organizations. Our goals are to increase the number of resident and non-resident travelers to Minnesota to grow receipts, tax revenues, and increase employment. Our agency, which gives you a little perspective of some of the budget things we'll talk about today, we have about 65 full and part-time staff, 50 full-time equivalents, offices in Brainerd, Duluth, Thief River Falls, and Mankato, as well as our headquarter office in St. Paul. And we also have travel information centers, six staffed with state staff, as well as various partnership and affiliate centers. We basically serve four basic functions: communications, industry relations, marketing, research, and operations. In our communications area, we focus a lot on media relations, as well as the ExploreMinnesota.com website. Our marketing research is a lot that maybe many of you have seen, involving our broadcast, TV, and radio, focusing primarily in the North Central region. We have industry relations offices in five regions throughout the state. We also award grants to local tourism organizations to help them in their tourism marketing. And then the operations in the consumer area is sort of where the rubber meets the road, where consumers contact us through a variety of means: website, phone calls, travel information centers, et cetera. And these measures here is what we key against in terms of our main goals: growing gross sales. This shows the growth of leisure and hospitality sales since 1975, the growth of sales tax revenue, the growth of employment of 248,000. That actually started to dip for the first time in 2008, feeling the effects of the downturn in the economy. So it's the first year we've actually had a decrease in the jobs growth.
How many of those are seasonal?
I think those are part I'm really not sure. I have to find out, Mr. Chairman. Those are figures from the Department of Revenue, and I'm not sure how they count full-time equivalents or part-time, but I can get the answer for you for that. Our website, exploreminnesota.com, is the primary area where people go for travel information and planning. And we have basically developed a consumer website based on consumers talking about their favorite things to do in Minnesota. And we also, this last year, did extensive partnership marketing with a wide variety of private sector partners, generating about $1 million in cash and in-kind support, and generating over 150,000 inquiries through promotions that we did throughout the summer, the fall, and this winter. And I usually don't mention awards. I always say about awards, they're not important until you win one. So we did win, actually, two out of the last 5 years. And it is actually an accomplishment that my staff is very proud of, because the competition for this, and this is basically for the best overall travel marketing in the United States, is the competition is not just state tourism offices. It's also private sector groups as well. And so that's something we're very proud of. And then we're also engaged in a Travel Green program. This was the result of a legislative direction of a task force to promote sustainable tourism in Minnesota, and I can give you more information about that. Now to the budget, the information that you really want to know about. Our current fiscal year budget is about a $10 million operating budget. Included in there is $500,000 in public-private incentive funding. Also through our budget is the Minnesota Film and TV Board, their operational funding, as well as money, $650,000 a year for snowbait money, for a total of $11.13 million for our Explore Minnesota Tourism on an annual basis.
The snowbait stuff, that was all passed through?
Yes, that was. We just administer those dollars that go directly from us, Mr. Chair, to the Minnesota Film and TV Board.
All right.
And so we rank basically our budget as comparison to other states. We're about 30th in the 50 states. The private sector match is something that we have to raise in order to generate this $500,000 incentive. That match is basically three private sector dollars for each incentive dollar received from the state. How our budget is broken down is basically along the lines of the operational units I mentioned: communications, 8%, marketing research, 39%, industry relations and grants, 16%, the operations and consumer services, 30%, and the travel information centers, 7%. And the Snowbait program that I mentioned is a jobs program. Last legislative session, in addition to the money that was appropriated for the Snowbait, we also, the legislature directed an additional $500,000 as a one-time appropriation for a special film project last year, and that did go through the Explore Minnesota Tourism budget. Now, one thing before I get into the next biennium I do want to mention is that there was an allotment this year of the Explore Minnesota Tourism budget to help with the current shortfall of $300,000. That $300,000 was arrived at by basically figuring 5% of the unspent budget as of December 5th. And so what we did in order to absorb that 5% is reduce some of our fulfillment costs, putting less emphasis on inquiry-generating tactics. We eliminated one group and one travel trade show, reduced some of our purchase research, and we eliminated our winter grants for next year. That's really only amounts to about $60,000, about 15 or so communities with a cap of about $5,000. But there wasn't a significant amount of use of the winter grant program. That was a way for us to immediately absorb that unallotment. So, Mr. Chairman and members, when we get to the fiscal year 10 and 11 budget recommendations, the governor's recommendation includes a $1.1 million reduction in base funding for Explore Minnesota Tourism for each of the next two fiscal years. We still have the incentive funding, which is the $500,000. We have to generate money from the private sector in order to earn that. And then basically our recommended the reduction just on the operational in this budget is about 10% of the operational money for Explore Minnesota Tourism. Now, a question I'm sure you all have that I had is, so what are you going to do about that? How is that going to impact your operations? And we went through some extensive reviews with our managers and our staff to find out how we can reduce these amounts. We're going to delay some enhancements on our consumer website. If you know anything about consumer websites, they're changing all the time. They're never done, but there are some things we'd like to have, but we're just going to have to put off. We're going to reduce the amount that we're paying out in professional and technical contracts. We can reduce some of those amounts through the contract negotiations. Reduce some print production costs by basically putting more things online. And then we're still going to retain our partnership and our innovative grant programs, but we are going to reduce the amount that's available to those programs. Something to keep in mind there is that the last biennium, our budget went up $1 million per biennium, and we increased that biennium, the amount that we put into grants. This year, we're going back to basically where we were 2 years ago, but we're still continuing the grant programs to communities. We're also going to reduce some marketing partnerships, some shows and educational events. There is a slight decrease in the Snowbait funding. We talked to the Minnesota Film and TV Board about how to also absorb approximately a 10% reduction. It was their recommendation to keep the operational funding at the same level but reduce the amount for the Snowbait. So in the governor's budget, there still is money for the Snowbait. I think it's approximately $560,000. But there is money each year to continue on the Snowbait. So the bottom line is it's a $1 million decrease in our funding each year. It is going to impact our operations, increase our ability to market, but we've been able to readjust programs to continue to fulfill our mission to promote travel to Minnesota.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Edmund. As you know, tourism is very important to the economy of my district, and I'm sure that's true of, you know, some of the other legislators here more than some others. Is there any way to predict? I'm especially concerned where you the part of your slide that said reduce overall marketing of travel in state. Is there any way to predict the impact of that reduction in revenue is likely to have on jobs that are reliant on your marketing efforts? I mean, outside of your agency and people who work directly for your agency, what about the other jobs that are dependent on your marketing?
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's very difficult to predict an exact amount of how it's going to impact our overall marketing. We're not going to be able to do a lot of the things that we were doing before. But in some of these next slides, what I was just talking about, next year is going to be a year unlike any other that we've ever had before, not just with our budget, but with consumer travel behavior. Consumer confidence is at an all-time low. People are not going to be traveling as much as they have in the past, but they are still going to travel. People still need to get away to relief of stress, mental and physical health. So what we're doing is actually we're changing our messaging. We're changing our messages to focus more on travel closer to home, to focus on shorter stays, closer to home type travel. And we're actually right now putting together some revised messaging about take a break. Consumers need to take a break. And we think that's important, not just for our industry, but as you mentioned, Senator, with all of those other businesses upon which our industry depends. We're basically faced with the same budget challenges you are, and we're trying to do the best we can to adjust our message to keep tourism strong in this difficult economy.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, Mr. Edmund, you know, every other agency who's been here has talked to us about how they're increasing fees and licenses so that the service the government has provided is somehow paid for by the user of that service. And I just wonder if there wouldn't be an interest within the industry of doing more marketing on your website that where you could actually recapture some of those losses and, you know, link to clips, you know, just make it as interactive as possible and then charge some fees that would, you know, amount to kind of a win-win to try to retain that revenue. Is that a possibility?
Well,
Mr. Chair, Senator, we've actually been very successful in generating revenue through our website for those parts of the industry that want to participate and pay more. We've taken some of our sales in-house in order to do that, and we've been able to recapture more of those fees. In talking to the industry right now, I'm very reluctant to increase more fees onto the industry when so many businesses are challenged and hurting right now. So we're looking for other partnerships to do that. I guess the bottom line answer to your question is that we do look to the industry to help us out with our marketing, but frankly, there are limits on how much we can charge the industry, and we're very, very cautious on those fees that we bring back to the industry.
Any other questions? It looks to me like you're not going to be laying anybody off, though.
Mr. Chair, at this point, we've basically, if things stand the way that they are, we will be able to keep our staff intact. We will not be filling vacant positions and things like that. Through the steps that I mentioned, we're able to continue on. If the cuts get deeper than that, we're going to have to reevaluate every single program. But we have a relatively small, lean, and mean organization, and we're trying to keep them working to the best of their ability with the resources that we have.
And do you have any vacant positions accounted for in the budget as if they were going to be filled?
Not in the budget that we have prepared for you right now. Had we had an increase, we probably would have filled a couple of positions, but we made the decisions not only not to fill a couple of those positions, but also to reallocate duties of some, in fact, some senior managers that have just recently retired, and using existing staff, dividing duties to still get the job done.
So you have 51 FTEs, in is that correct?
I believe it's 50 around 50 FTEs, yes.
I don't know what 50.9 means, but 51?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And they're
all accounted for and paid for, and they're all working, right, in this budget proposal?
Keep us this way, and yes, they will be.
All right, okay. Any other questions? Okay, if not, we may be in touch as bills come along. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Just one last point I just want to mention in this program is that we have engaged in a process throughout the industry this last fall talking about what we want the future of tourism to be in our state, meeting with people all throughout Minnesota on a 2020 vision process. And we're really trying to look beyond the current crisis to where we want this industry to go, what we have to do, not just in the area of marketing, but also in the issues dealing with business operations, the environment, transportation. And we'll have that report for you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the legislature within a month. You can take a look at what the vision of our industry should be.
Just as long as you brought that up, just out of curiosity, is there are you guys looking at any possibility of tapping into the constitutional money? Do you think you qualify under any of the categories?
Mr. Chair, members, at this point, I wouldn't rule anything out. Our primary focus, however...
Be careful here now.
Yeah. our primary focus right now is to work with existing agencies to try to look at the resources that are already in existence. I'm having discussions, for example, with the Department of Natural Resources, who have seen basically a flatlining of people buying park passes and trail passes. They depend more on revenue from that to fund a lot of their operations. We're looking at ways that we can help agencies like that with marketing using some of the resources that they already have in cooperative agreements, and I'm hoping to do that with other agencies as well. So that's actually a big focus of how we're continuing to try to promote Minnesota with the limited resources we have. The legacy money is certainly an option, but it's not our prime focus at this point in time.
Okay, and I got to assume that you're probably looking to market Minnesota to Minnesotans even more than ever based on what's going on.
Mr. Chair, members, that's absolutely correct. People are looking to take a break to discover what's in their own backyard, and we have so much in this state, the parks, the trails, the small towns, the large towns, the lakes, the rivers, and we're going to be marketing that more than ever to people right here in our own state.
Any comments or questions from committee members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Ms. Jens, you're up next.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Jens, and am I not on the microphone? I am the interim executive director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and like the other presenters today, I appreciate the opportunity to give you a little bit of an overview of who we are, what we do, why we think it's important to the state, and then I will also update you on what the governor has included for the Arts Board in his budget.
Ms. Jens, how long have you been interim?
A year yesterday.
Are they going to hire you, or are they looking for somebody else, or what are they doing here?
Mr. Chair, I never get out ahead of my board. They are close to a decision.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Would you like to tell me how many pages of the handout I should tear off?
I would like you to tell us how important you are and what the governor's budget is like, and give me some core functions and how you operate.
Okay.
And you may want to address the constitutional issue also.
Sure. Yeah. All righty. The handout that you, I know you have the budget documents from the governor's office, and the handout that I had put in your packet today just pulls out a few highlights that I wanted to stress as I go through the documents. First of all, obviously, you have in the budget documents in our agency profile, you have our mission, you have our vision, you have some of our key goals. But I wanted to highlight that in our vision, where it talks about Minnesotans having the opportunity to participate in the arts, we think about participation very broadly. And we don't think that just means being in a theater or being in a museum, but we also think that it means participating in the benefits that the arts produce for the state, the economic benefits, the educational benefits, the other sorts of public benefits that the arts produce. I will go very quickly through the next few slides. I wanted to give you kind of a context of the importance of the arts in the state. And I've included some statistics that we have through research or through other observations that show that Minnesotans, constituents of all of yours, care about the arts and why they care about the arts. They participate in them individually. They think the arts need to be accessible throughout the state, and public funding helps that. They think the arts are important in education, in making Minnesota an attractive place to live and work. These last two slides really relate to economic development, obviously. You asked about the constitutional amendment, and clearly Minnesotans expressed their interest in supporting the arts by voting heavily in favor of that. But collectively, as a state, we care about the arts as well because of the things that they do for the state in return for that investment. I think some of you know that there was an economic impact study done a few years ago that proved that the arts are a $1 billion industry in the state. They support jobs. They bring revenue into local and state government coffers. And the surveys were, the research was done in two parts. So it looked at arts and cultural organizations. It also looked at individual artists as small businesses, as entrepreneurs. And so you have some information about the footprint of that impact, that economic impact. We also think that the arts are important to the state because as you wrestle with how to bring jobs in, how to create new industries, how to shore up our economic future, there are ways that the arts can play a role in that. We can help attract workers to the creative or information economies. You've talked a little bit today about film, but design, fashion, graphic arts, architecture, all of those are the kinds of things that the arts can help foster. We also are a part of the tourism industry. Cultural heritage tourism is a growing sector. There's national research that shows cultural heritage tourists visit longer, and they spend more money when they're visiting. So that's a niche that we could work with the tourism department to try to maximize. Preparing children for successful futures obviously is an economic issue within the state, and there's research that shows that the arts do help students do better in school, do better on their college exams, and be more successful and productive. And finally, the last is the arts can help us position the state in the global marketplace. Anything we can do to bring visibility to the state, to make this place a distinct place to live and work that's different from some of our Midwestern neighbors or some of the other states, we'd like to help play a part in that. So that's the context. That's the overview, very quickly. The Arts Board itself is, we aren't a state agency per se. We are an administrative board. We were created in statute. Actually, the first time it's mentioned in statute was 1903. So there have been investments in the arts for more than 100 years. And this is what the statute directs us to do. We have 11 board members, all of whom are volunteers. They're appointed by the governor. They serve with the advice and consent of the Senate. We are very heavily dependent on volunteer help. We use more than 100 volunteers every year to help us review grant applications, to help us make decisions about public art pieces, and to help us with all of the programming that we do. So you see we have at least 100-plus volunteers a year. All of our processes are subject to the open meeting law. We're very transparent. We are a tiny staff of 10. Mr. Edmund said they're lean and mean. I think we're probably leaner and a little meaner because of it. Two of those positions at the moment are open, and we have been waiting to see how the budget process plays out to make some decisions.
Two of the 10 positions are open?
Two of the 10 at the moment. The other thing that's unique about the Arts Board is that our statute requires us to be the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils, and here you have the map of how those regions cover the entire state. They are, for the most part, private nonprofit organizations. We make block grants to them, and they are responsible for local decision-making. They have final authority over those dollars, and they are directed to develop targeted programs and services to meet their region. They submit a biennial plan to the Arts Board, which we review, we approve, and they also submit reports to us. Each of the regional arts councils has generally one staff person. There's one that has a few more, but they're very small as well.
How did you determine, how did we determine how to draw that up? Is it a population thing? I mean, we should get credit for wolves or something up in our area.
As I understand it, the boundaries, Mr. Chair, were drawn in the 1970s, and they were based on the Regional Development Commission boundaries.
Okay.
I believe, this obviously predates me at the Arts Board, but I believe that all of them started as programs of the local Regional Development Commission, and all but two of them have now evolved out or graduated out and have gone on to be independent. Two of them still are programs based in a Regional Development Commission.
Okay.
So that's why you see the boundaries. And there is obviously quite a bit of difference in the sizes of the boundaries. The block grant amounts are actually determined by a formula that the Regional Arts Councils agree on together. It's based heavily on population, but it also does factor in size. So, for example, Region 3, which that director has to cover a lot of territory. There's a factoring for the amount of geography he's responsible for serving. We, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils, I really believe, were created to be a way to distribute public investment in the arts. Our principal business, both the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils, are to be grant makers. And all of us do the same basic kinds of things. We fund arts organizations, schools, artists, and community organizations. And with this two-tiered structure, we can be looking both at statewide needs and priorities, and we can be looking at local needs and priorities, and that way create, we hope, a pretty seamless approach to dealing with the opportunities that are out there. I've included one slide from last biennium to give you a sense of the number of requests that we're dealing with in any given biennium. The Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils together last year received about 3,500 grant requests. And processed all those. The total was about $27 million in requests. It's important, I think, to keep in mind that we often, and the Regional Arts Councils will often, cap the amount of money that an organization can ask for. So we believe that this request amount could be really significantly higher if there weren't caps on some of those grant programs. We were able to collectively make 2,200 grants in the last biennium, totaling $15 million. And if you hearken back to the slide about the 1,400 arts organizations and 30,000 artists, you can see that we're touching, at this point, a pretty small tip of the iceberg, and that there are an awful lot of arts organizations, an awful lot of arts programs in community organizations and in schools, and individual artists who certainly are eligible for support and could perhaps make bigger contributions to the state if we were able to work with them. The other statistic about this slide that I think is important is that these 2,200 funded activities last biennium touched a combined audience of about 18 million people. So, again, the footprint is really quite large when you think about the number of people that are being served by these dollars. The Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils do some programming and some services, and I've just given you a summary of the kinds of things we're trying to accomplish through those. We try to shore up and build the capacity of the nonprofit arts sector. They're small businesses as well, and they need help with ideas about fundraising and board development. Professional artists tend to operate as sole proprietors, individual businesses, entrepreneurs, and so workshops or artistic or professional development activities help them succeed. Some of the others we've already talked about. Integrating the arts into education. ADA compliance is a requirement we get from the federal government. We are funded with a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, and that brings with us some ADA requirements as well. And it's also the right thing to do. Okay. Flipping over to the financial information. The first slide I'm giving you here is just a summary or an overview of appropriations to the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils over an approximate 10-year period of time.
Are these state appropriations or are these?
These are state appropriations. Okay. This is general fund state appropriations. And in the session laws every 2 years, the appropriation is written in with three line items. There's the Regional Arts Council block grants, which is the green slice at the top of each of these. There's a slice called operations and services, which comes to the Arts Board to be used for programming and our administrative staff and some of those costs. And then the blue slice is the grant programs that the Arts Board administers. So if you take the green and the blue together, those are basically the grant dollars that go out the door out of the Arts Board. And the red slice is about 6% of the overall state appropriation. So it's a very, very small amount of money
at this point. The employees of the regional arts councils, they're not counted in the 10 that you talked about, are they? Or are they?
Pardon me, I didn't hear that, Mr. Chair.
The employees that work for the regional arts councils, are they included in the 10 employees? They're not included in those 10?
Mr. Chair, no, they aren't. They
okay,
are.
So how many people do we have working in the regional arts councils?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to estimate it's about 15 people.
And are they paid for by the green slice?
They are paid for by the green slice,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Moving on, you do have in the budget book pages 5, 6 and 7 are the actual documents. What I've done on this slide is to pull out the federal money, the private money, and to focus on the general fund dollars that the governor is including in his budget. I've given you fiscal year 08-09 and the totals for those three appropriations lines that I mentioned. In fiscal year 10, the governor is recommending a 33% reduction to the base budget. In fiscal year 2011, the governor is recommending a two-thirds, basically a 66% reduction in those general fund dollars. Fiscal year 12 and 13, the governor is recommending no general fund dollars to the Arts Board or to the Regional Arts Councils. He also says in the narrative of his proposal that by 2012 he expects the Arts Board to have transitioned out of state government and have become a private nonprofit organization.
Does any of this money leverage any money from outside?
It does indeed, Mr. Chair. The Arts Board, speaking for the Arts Board, which I'm more familiar with than some of the specifics of the Regional Arts Council, the grant dollars that we are able to award generally are maybe 1 to 2% of the contributed budget of any organization, never more than 4 or 5%. We tend to be the single largest grant in many cases, but if you think about 1 to 2% of the budget versus all of the individual contributions, the private contributions, the dollars are leveraged dozens of times over.
And so, obviously, a 33% cut and a 66% cut is big. Are those, would that be staffing? Would that be just grants in general, combination of all? Maybe figured out what would happen if you actually get hit this hard?
Mr. Chair, I believe it would be all of the above, but we don't know specifics yet. In the 2 weeks since the governor announced his budget, we've started to think about what the impact would be. Trying to anticipate perhaps which grant programs would need to be, clearly grant programs would need to be reduced. Some would need to be eliminated, both at the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. Services clearly would be reduced. Some would be completely eliminated. At the Arts Board, there would be 3 staff members who would be laid off in fiscal 10 and an additional 3 in fiscal 11. Those are part of the governor's proposals. The Regional Arts Councils, it's a little more challenging because if they have only one staff person, the choice may be to go to part-time or to do some personnel sharing. So at this point, I can't come to you with specifics about how we would accommodate these kinds of cuts. What we are doing is thinking very carefully about what would the impact be, both to our internal operations, but more importantly to those organizations that we serve, to the artists that we serve, trying to get a sense of that. We're doing many things, but 3 in particular. We started a needs assessment last summer, trying to get a sense of what about the arts is most important to communities, to Minnesotans all around the state. And we intend to use that to guide some of our decisions as we move forward. We're talking to the other arts funders. Every funder that is funded at this point with an endowment is also seeing reductions based on the performance of the stock market. So we're trying to get a sense of how are they shifting their programs, you know, how should we direct public dollars versus the private dollars. The other thing we're doing is working with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits to try to get a sense of how the economic downturn is affecting nonprofit arts organizations. Using those and other input from stakeholders and other analysis we can do, we would try to come up with a plan that would best serve the citizens in the state with the resources that would be appropriated to us.
Do you have a feel for, as a potential nonprofit, do you have a feel for whether or not you'd be able to have the same type of interaction with other state agencies that you're having now?
Mr. Chair, that is one of our questions. What we're doing at the moment is trying to identify what might be the possible advantages of being a nonprofit, what would be the disadvantages of being a nonprofit, and what are the unknowns? What are the questions that we would need to try to sort through in order to make, if that transition actually goes through, what would that do to our effectiveness as an agency? And so all of that will be a part of that analysis process.
Now, I can't read the governor's mind, and I don't think I see it in his narrative. But I would believe the intent would be to get you funded by the constitutional amendment some way. And I don't know if you've heard that or not, or if you've thought about that, but I don't even know if I want you to comment on it or not, but go ahead. Senator Polk, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to hear your thoughts on the constitutional amendment and how that might affect the arts park.
Sure.
Or your hopes for it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, clearly we have hopes for some of those legacy amendment dollars coming to the Arts Board and to the Regional Arts Councils. There are four items that are listed in the Cultural and Heritage Fund for basic kinds of activities, and we really have some involvement in all four of those. So we think that we are a really good match for those dollars. We also think that the flexibility, the effectiveness, the accountability, and the transparency that we have already in this 30-plus-year-old system is an advantage, because we do believe that taxpayers are going to be monitoring pretty closely what happens to those dollars and what are the benefits, what are the long-term benefits that they can see in Minnesota. And so we do hope that some of those monies will be coming our way. Like you, Mr. Chair, I can't read the governor's mind. I don't know if his plan is for some of those dollars to be directed to us. He did not include that in his budget proposal.
See that. Okay. All right. Are the other groups that, whether they be some type of a fund that is contributing toward the arts that is matching funds for some of the state appropriations. Have you had discussions with any of those groups, that whether it be the McKnight Foundation or who it might be, whether how they would react to you being a 501c3 and how they would might change how they fund or what they would do differently? Have you had any kind of conversations with them?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. The Arts Board receives federal funding through the National Endowment for the Arts, and the requirement is that there be state funding to match dollar for dollar those federal funds. And right now that level is approximately $776,000 a year. And the NEA dollars come to us based on a formula that's very population-driven. So there isn't a lot we can do to affect how much of that money comes to us. It's also based on our activities in arts education and serving underserved communities. So there are some stipulations about how we would spend those dollars and what kind of match dollars we would have available. We believe if there were state funding, we would still qualify for those funds, but we need to clarify whether it has to be general fund dollars or if dedicated dollars are sufficient. So we will clarify that with the National Endowment for the Arts. Mr. Chair, you also mentioned the McKnight Foundation. They are the second principal funder of the Regional Arts Council system. That's also about a $700,000 investment each year. And we don't know yet how this might affect McKnight. I'll be talking to them next week to get a sense of what their concerns are about this and whether it would affect their giving.
I would assume you have a whole bunch of other ones that do the same thing.
Those are the two that really are the key ones, Mr. Chair. The federal money requires the match. The McKnight hasn't required a match, but they clearly understand the value of having both public and private investment together.
Okay. You have a question, Senator Sparks? Okay. I guess we don't have any answers for you yet either, so, but, okay.
If you do, Mr. Chair, we would welcome them.
All right. And I don't have any more questions. Do you have any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
I better not ask that. Go ahead. Mr. Romanstein. Where is it, Stein?
There you are.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I want to thank you and the members of the
committee for the opportunity to speak for just a few moments about the work of the Minnesota Humanities Center. My name is Stanley Robenstein, and I am very proud to be the president of the Humanities Center. Mr. Chairman, mindful of the hour and of your instructions to my colleagues who have been seated at this table, I will skip most of the poetry and go to the prose. If humanities is not a term that you can quickly and easily identify, you're probably not alone. Our late Governor Elmer Anderson once said to me, "Stanley, Minnesotans love the humanities. They just don't always know to call them that." And I think he was right. You can refer to the humanities collectively, or you can reference them individually: history, languages, literature, geography, civics and social studies, ethics, jurisprudence, poetry, the arts. Just know that Minnesotans do understand the fundamental importance of the humanities, even if the dictionary definition of that particular word might elude them. And if you're not that familiar with the work of the Minnesota Humanities Center, again, not to worry. Many of you know us as the agency charged by the legislature in 2008 with creating and coordinating the process that led to Governor Pawlenty's naming Robert Bly as our state's first poet laureate. The legislature asked us to handle that assignment because poetry is one of the humanities, yes, but the legislature asked us to accept responsibility for the process in large part because the Humanities Center has a statewide reach and because the Humanities Center is highly respected both in Minnesota and across the country for the quality and integrity of its work. The Humanities Center is a nonprofit organization. We're a 501c3, founded in 1971 and charged by the federal government, United States Congress, and the Minnesota State Legislature with using the humanities to create here in Minnesota a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society, not a small charge. How do we fulfill that mandate? First, we work directly with K-12 educators, schools, and school districts to improve student achievement and to close that much-talked-about achievement gap between underprivileged students and their classmates by creating rigorous professional development opportunities that transform teaching and engage students. The impact of our work has been documented by Minnesota's own Wilder Research Center, and it's brought us national recognition. Second, we create unique educational resources, books, DVDs, documentaries, podcasts, that strengthen literacy, particularly within Minnesota's underserved communities, African American, American Indian, and immigrant communities. Third, through our national partnerships with the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress, for example, we strengthen the work of dozens and dozens of other small cultural organizations, local historical societies, libraries, community centers, and learning and retirement organizations throughout the state and in greater Minnesota in particular. Fourth, we use state dollars to leverage significant investments by local, state, and national funders, including the Cargill Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. While economic impact is not the sole focus of the Humanities Center's work, it is a valuable and consistent byproduct of our work. In 2007, this body appropriated $500,000 in economic development funds to support the Humanities Center's work during the biennium. We took seriously the challenge to use those dollars wisely, and I'm pleased to report to you today, and this is included in your packets, that the Minnesota Humanities Center returned $7.1 million in economic impact on the state's $500,000 investment in our work. That's a return of more than $14 for every $1 we received from the state of Minnesota. The strong economic impact of our work is not coincidental. The Humanities Center's work is guided by a 30-member volunteer board, a board of citizens. Our board is comprised of business people, educators, and concerned citizens who take economic impact and economic development seriously. They work hand in hand with a staff that is also committed to economic development. We have a staff of 17 full-time employees and 7 part-time employees. You see them listed on the organizational chart that was included as a part of your packets. The Humanities Center's fiscal 09 operating budget is listed on the reverse of that page. Our operating budget for fiscal 09 totals $3.2 million. 13% of that, $525,000, comes from the state of Minnesota in economic development funds and through a one-time single-source grant through the Department of Education. The bulk of our revenue is contributed income, grants from corporations, foundations, and individuals. We are able to leverage those dollars because of the investment from the state of Minnesota. It is biennial budget.
Do the federal funds come with any strings?
Mr. Chairman, they do. Like our colleagues at the State Arts Board, we are required to match federal dollars, dollar for dollar, with state funds.
And do you know if that means general fund money, or does that mean any kind of funding? Could it be from the contributed income? Could it be from a different source? Or does it have to be from taxpayers' dollars?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain of that answer. I know it has to be matched by the state, but if there are particular requirements, I'd be happy to investigate that with my colleagues at the federal level. In his biennial budget, Governor Pawlenty has recommended that all financial support for the Minnesota Humanities Center's work be eliminated. Should the legislature follow Governor Pawlenty's recommendations, the impact to the Humanities Center and to the hundreds of thousands of people with whom we work every year would be, frankly, catastrophic. There is a single page, the last that we've included in your packet, that outlines the impact of those budget recommendations. If I can summarize them for you very quickly, under the first section, the grants that we extend, the partnerships that we extend, Smithsonian programs, authors and community programs, grants to lifelong learning organizations throughout the state would end as of July 1st. We would no longer sponsor those organizations. We would no longer participate in their programming. Most of those organizations are located in Greater Minnesota. The second impact would be that we would close the Humanities Center here in St. Paul. It's an absolutely beautiful facility that the state built or renovated in 1996. It is the old education wing of Gillette Children's Hospital, located on the east side of St. Paul near Lake Phelan. Various bodies of the legislature have met there from time to time. A lot of state agencies and other nonprofit organizations meet there, but we would close the center. We simply could not afford to operate it. Out of our 15 full-time and 7 part-time employees, there would be a loss, an immediate loss on July 1st of 7 full-time positions, about half of our staff, and there would be an economic impact in that we would not be extending our work into Greater Minnesota. There'd be a loss of over $3 million during the biennium.
Pretty good bang for the buck, huh?
Mr. Chairman, we like to think so.
Senator Koch, you're grabbing your microphone.
Mr. Chair. Doctor, I'm just wondering, because it's $250,000 a year, that's 7 employees and all your program. I'm just looking at, it's 13% of your revenue. I'm just trying to work those numbers in my head. Why the significant loss? It's $500,000, which I understand is a large amount of money. I don't sniff at that. But that just seems like some very drastic measures for what is really a fairly small percent of your budget.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, if you simply look at the reduction of that one pot of state money, it's one thing. But if you look at the potential loss of federal dollars because we would not have state dollars to match, you multiply the effect. And we've heard from our funders in the community, if the state is not making an investment, why should the private sector make a state investment in things that are essentially public responsibilities? We've always operated as a public-private partnership, and we proudly claim the support of the Cargill Foundation and the McKnight Foundation and others, but they have said to us, it's no longer a public-private partnership if the public steps away, and that the private sector would have to reevaluate its commitment to your programs as well. So we're looking at a leverage effect, a multiplier effect of the withdrawal of those state dollars.
Thank you.
So ultimately, your 51% would go away, and you wouldn't have any earned income either.
Mr. Chairman, that's a distinct possibility.
Okay. All right. What's your feeling on the constitutional amendment and whether or not you may qualify for any of the arts money?
Mr. Chairman,
I saw the word arts up there when you were putting up all those things that the humanities are, so I'm just wondering if...
Well, Mr. Chairman, our understanding is that what Minnesotans voted for was to support arts and culture, and we think that we need to focus a little bit on what culture is and what culture means. We think that the arts are a vital and integral part of who we are as Minnesotans and what we voted to preserve and enhance, but there are other things like literacy programs and lifelong learning programs and education of the kind that we provide that we think is critical and that we think clearly fits under the banner of the Heritage Amendment and as part of what Minnesotans were voting in favor of.
Okay. Those little tabs you have on the map there, are those buildings or are they just programs or what are those?
Mr. Chairman, those are programs. They are not buildings.
Those are programs. Okay.
Right.
All right. And do you want to tell that cute little story you told me when you came into my office? Because I got about 2 minutes before I got to adjourn. I really like this story.
I visited the chairman's office 2 years ago with my son Benjamin, who was then 2 years old, and I hesitated, but it was a snowy day, and I had my son with me, and Senator Tomassoni was very kind and welcomed my toddler into his office, and my toddler very quickly climbed up in Senator Tomassoni's lap and began to play in his desk. And again, the chairman was very kind and tolerated my son's behavior. I visited the chairman's office again last week, and as I was getting ready for the day, my son said to me, "So, Dad, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Well, I have some meetings at the state capitol." And I said, "You actually know one of the men that I'm going to be talking with today." And I mentioned Senator Tomassoni's name, and my son immediately said, "Oh, that's that nice man who let me play in his desk." You made a lasting impression.
That's worth $500 right there.
If it's worth more, I can bring the kid back. He's quite a charmer.
Okay. All right. I think that's it. I'm assuming there's probably going to be bills coming through and everything. So we may need you back for testimony and to help us probably try and figure out what we're going to do in regards to the Legacy Act. So any ideas or suggestions, let us know. I think we're. Cap, do we have? Are we done going through? Sorry, are we done going through our budget, or do we have more committees that have to come in?
Mr. Chair, I believe we have one more small. I believe the Combative Sports Commission has not yet come before us, and I think they have some organizational. Their meeting is a board at some point to discuss, because I believe the governor zeroed them out in the next biennium. But that's pretty much the summation of our budget overviews. Next week we will hear a few more
Court of Appeals
bills. We have not. There are some smaller agencies that in the past we have not heard from and did not come before committee. So there are some that we have not done. We have not always brought in every agency or every account that we have oversight over. But we can.
Okay. All right. So we may have a few more overviews of agencies and go through a little bit more of the budget booklet. For the most part, we've gotten through the heavy lifting. And next week on Monday?
Next week we will be hearing some bills. Of one note to committee members, on March 2nd, it looks like we are going to be taking a small field trip that may go into the evening, so members should instruct their staffs to block out some of that time. We will be going to Senator Ortman's district.
This is by request from Senator Ortman, so we're accommodating a request to take a look at some of the stuff that's going on in her district in regards to Job Z. So
we can go for
with that,
dinner in my district.
Meeting adjourned.